The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and it's time for another edition of Civics 101, a podcast refresher course on some basics you may have forgotten or slept through in school.
She was warned. She was given an explanation. Nevertheless, she persisted.
That is Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell defending his decision to stop Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren from speaking during the debate over Jeff Sessions' nomination for Attorney General. McConnell barred Warren from further discussion for violating Rule 19, a rarely invoked rule prohibiting a member of the Senate from impugning another senator or conduct or motive unworthy or unbecoming a senator. There are 44 rules governing how the Senate operates. The more questions we got about Senate rules, the less we understood which parts of conduct are rules and what is custom. To sort it all out, we found Alan Fruman, who is Senate Parliamentarian Emeritus. He served in the Senate Parliamentarian's office from 1977 to 2012 and was on two occasions Chief Parliamentarian from 1987 to 1995 and again from 2001 to 2012. Alan, welcome to Civics 101.
I'm delighted to be here.
What does the Senate parliamentarian do?
The Senate parliamentarian is basically the referee on the floor of the Senate. It's the parliamentarian's responsibility to advise whoever is presiding over the Senate as to appropriate Senate procedure at any point in the proceedings.
It's an interesting term, parliamentarian. I mean, when the framers were designing our Constitution and Bill of Rights and conduct, there was a kind of avoidance of references to Englishness. Are the Senate rules and the Senate parliamentarian established in the Constitution?
No.
So who makes them up?
Well, the rules that the Senate uses, the standing rules, go all the way back to 1789. Or several of them go back to 1789. And in 1789, in the first Senate, they did look to English practice for the basic Senate rules. But over the years, they have evolved away from that.
So there are 44 Senate rules now. You know, you look through them, you can see they're about, you know, morning business, voting procedures, committee procedure. Which are actually used most often?
Well, you started this discussion by mentioning Elizabeth Warren running afoul of Rule 19. That's the rule that governs debate and decorum in debate. And it's a rule that Senate parliamentarians, shall we say, are skeptical of or leery of.
What do you mean?
Well, if somebody raises a Rule 19 violation on the floor of the Senate, that means that tempers are running very hot. And it means that senators are angry at each other. And it's the rule that we refer to as the shut up and sit down rule. And Elizabeth Warren's experience illustrates that she was made to shut up and sit down. And it's really something that a Senate parliamentarian is loath to be involved in because, believe it or not, senators are not delighted when a Senate staffer tells them to sit down and shut up.
But I was wondering about that. You said that your role was as a referee. So did anybody say to Mitch McConnell after that, well, actually, Senator, there is precedent for this. I mean, what happens in a case like that?
Well, we try to research the precedents. If we know in advance that somebody might challenge a senator for language that he or she is using on the floor of the Senate, we will look for precedents so that we can tell a senator that the language you used is comparable to the language used in the past that resulted in a violation of Rule 19. But as I said, it's something that when we hear and when I heard that there was a Rule 19 issue on the floor of the Senate as a safely retired Senate parliamentarian, what that meant to me was that things had gotten very nasty on the floor of the Senate.
Who educates incoming senators about all these rules?
The Senate parliamentarian does give orientation sessions. There's usually one or two orientation sessions that are set up formally by the Secretary of the Senate, to whom the parliamentarian answers. And individual senators certainly are free to make appointments to come to the Senate, to the parliamentarian's office, to sit down and become a little better educated in the rules and precedents of the Senate.
What is the difference between a rule, a precedent, and a procedure?
Well, procedure is more or less the generic term, the umbrella term, that encompasses both rules and, as you pointed out, the standing rules of the Senate, 44 of them, and activity that occurs, precedents, which are interpretations of the Senate's rules, or simply decisions about procedure. One example I like to cite is that there's nothing in the standing rules about English as the official acknowledged language on the floor of the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, when senators would wish to speak in a foreign language, I would make them get unanimous consent, basically waiving any prohibition in the rules, get unanimous consent, requiring the permission of every senator. And so that would be a precedent, basically telling a senator that you would need unanimous consent to speak in Spanish, let's say, or French or Russian on the floor of the Senate. There's no rule whatsoever that addresses that.
How about the manner of speaking on the floor of the Senate? You know, the chair recognizes the honorable senator from Delaware kind of thing. They don't refer to each other by their first name. The way they mention motions, is that a rule or custom?
That's pretty much custom. The rule does require the presiding officer to recognize the first senator who addresses the chair. That's by rule. But by custom and precedent, senators do not address each other directly. They don't use the word you. By precedent, senators address one another in the third person. So if Senator Warren wanted to speak to, let's say, Senator Shaheen, she wouldn't look at Senator Shaheen and say you.
Mm-hmm.
She would say the senator from New Hampshire.
Right.
And they are supposed to address each other through the chair. So Senator Warren, to follow proper practice procedure, would say, Madam President or Mr. President, will the senator from New Hampshire yield for a question? And say, Madam President, I'm addressing a question to the senator from New Hampshire. Isn't it true that that New Hampshire gets much more snow than Massachusetts and has much better skiing?
So how often are new rules made? I know from speaking to a previous guest about Rule 22 on cloture added in 1917. Do the rules get amended or appended?
It's quite rare for the standing rules to be amended. As you said, there are XLIV of them, 44 of them, and I believe there were 44 of them when I began working in the Senate, or maybe 42. When I began working in the Senate in 1977. So it is very rare to actually amend the standing rules. It's even more rare to add a new rule. From time to time, the existing rules are tweaked.
Standing rule number 6 is about quorum and states absentee senators may be sent for. Did that ever happen? Were senators ever summoned to the floor when you were parliamentarian?
Oh, yes, it did.
Really? They would go and get a senator?
Oh, yes, they would. And sent for means, and I think the motion there is, well, either explicitly in the rule or by precedent, the motion that is involved in sending for senators is to, quote, compel attendance.
Whoa.
Yes, whoa. Whoa is right. And what compel means is arrest.
So you could go arrest a senator who didn't show up for a vote on the Senate floor or even deliberation.
Well, not me. I would send you to arrest them. But since you were not around in February of 1988, we needed to send the Senate Sergeant-at-Arms out to arrest certain senators. This was a filibuster, an ongoing filibuster in mid-February 1988, possibly February 22, 3, and 4. The Republican minority was filibustering against a proposal to impose campaign finance reform, and the Republicans were filibustering in part by hiding, by denying the majority Democrats a quorum. And in frustration, the Democratic leader at the time, the majority leader, Senator Robert C. Byrd of West Virginia, made a motion to compel the attendance of absent senators. And what that meant was arrest warrants. And so I had to have my assistant in my office dust off decades-old arrest warrants, which we filled out. And the first senator that the sergeant-at-arms encountered, apparently, was Lowell Weicker of Connecticut. And Lowell Weicker stood 6'8", and I think had a substantial body on that 6'8" frame. And as rumor had it, he simply looked at the sergeant-at-arms and said, "You and what army?" At which point, the sergeant-at-arms went looking for more senators and found Senator Robert Packwood of Oregon.
Considerably smaller.
Somewhat smaller than Lowell Weicker. And he was, well, he was willing to play along. And so that night, Bob Packwood of Oregon entered the Senate chamber feet first, being carried by the sergeant-at-arms and I think one assistant.
Oh, my goodness.
It was a wonderful visual, which I believe the C-SPAN cameras did not capture.
Alan Fruman, it is wonderful to speak with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Alan Fruman is Senate Parliamentarian Emeritus. He served in the office from 1977 to 2012 and was promoted on two separate occasions to Chief Parliamentarian by both political party, the only Senate Parliamentarian to hold that distinction. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
So the app is called Face App. That's the little icon there.
Earlier this week, producer Logan Shannon pulled me into a studio to look at a smartphone app that has gone ultra viral in recent weeks.
And the way it works is you take a selfie, mm-hmm. and then you have a few options for filters.
Instead of tinting the screen sepia-toned or color-saturated or black and white like Instagram and other photo apps, the FaceApp filter uses neural networks to transform your face.
You should take your headphones off. And I would maybe tuck your hair behind your ear.
So once you've taken your selfie, you press a little baby-faced emoji, and voila, you get a glossy, cherubic makeover.
Ah! That's so weird. There's something like Teletubby-ish or something strange.
It does something, like softens all your edges.
It's too smooth.
It's very smooth.
It's too smooth.
Or if you can handle it, you can press the emoji with gray hair and wrinkles and see what you might look like in 20 or 30 years.
Oh, no, yours is pretty good.
No, I just look like me except older.
All right, let's change this one.
As you might guess, it's the sort of novelty app that can add some office humor on a sleepy afternoon.
He looks like he's going to spin your yarn.
It sounds like I'm cute as an old man.
You are adorable.
But as it turns out, the algorithms behind FaceApp have a dark downside. When it first came out, there was a so-called hotness filter, which was supposed to make you hotter, whatever that means. But for black and brown folks, the hot filter lightened skin, narrowed noses, and not surprisingly, set Twitter aflame. Decided to pick the hot filter, not knowing it would make me white, said one Twitter user. It's 2017. Come on, guys. Hot filter equals bleach my skin and make my nose your opinion of European. Hashtag uninstalled, said another. Not long after the app and the outrage went viral, the company behind FaceApp apologized and changed the name of the offending filter to Sparkle. But the damage was done and the fix a half measure. As people have already said in articles and social media, this product was not designed for me. So how does an algorithm become biased? The FaceApp debacle reminded us of a conversation we had last year with Rose Eveleth, host of the podcast Flash Forward, also a contributor to Vice, where she wrote about bias and something very similar, facial recognition software. So you talk about some very clear cases where facial recognition has failed pretty spectacularly. Can you share some of those cases with us?
Yeah, so there are a couple that have come up recently. Google's image tagging algorithm actually labeled a pair of friends who are African-American as gorillas. Flickr's system actually made the same mistake and tagged a black man with the tag animal and ape. Nikon's cameras, and this is a little bit older example, but Nikon's cameras were designed for a while to detect when someone blinked, and they often told Asian people that they were blinking, even when they were not. And sort of the classic first example that I think a lot of people maybe saw a couple of years ago was HP had some webcams, and they were supposed to track a face, and when a white person moved in front of the camera, it immediately picked up the face and tracked them, and when a black face moved in front of the camera, it didn't see it at all. Mm. So there's a lot of examples of this. It sort of seems like there's all kinds of ways that this comes up over and over, but those are some of the probably the most famous ones.
So what does that reveal to us about how the technology is created and who it's designed to serve?
So algorithms, you know, people think like, oh, algorithms are just computers and they can't have bias because they're computers. And in some ways that is true because it is a computer and it does not yet think on its own. However, it is designed by people. And we know very well that people have a lot of inherent biases that they aren't aware of and some of them that they are aware of. And so very rarely is it the case that some engineer, you know, is sitting at Google and saying like, aha, I'm going to make this algorithm, you know, be racist. But what they do is they train these algorithms on sets of images and sets of faces and sets of things that they're going to show them to say, hey, when you see this, this is what you're looking for. This is what an eye looks like. This is what a nose looks like. This is what you're looking for when you see an eye is open. And often those sets of data that they're training the algorithm on are made up of faces that look very similar. So mostly European, mostly white people. And so when the computer sees a face that looks different, that is not a white face, it doesn't really know what to do because it hasn't seen enough of them to know how to respond. So it makes these mistakes. Now, in some cases with like Google and Flickr, when we talked about the people being labeled as gorillas or animals, that's an even more complicated problem because they're trying to solve something that's more complex than facial recognition. They're trying to teach their computer to recognize any object. So they want to know this is an apple and this is an orange and this is a tree and this is a person. And that's even harder. And that means that they're showing it fewer of the same kind of thing, so fewer people, which means that it sort of amplifies this question of the computer not really knowing what it's looking at.
But still, the idea that a white face is a normal face, I guess, is what we're coming away with. Have you spoken to anybody in the technology business who designs this to see how they responded to questions about bias?
Yeah, so I've talked to a couple of people who work on facial recognition, and all of them say the same thing. They say, you know, we're not going in trying to make a bias system. But what I think a lot of them don't quite realize is that many people who go into technology aren't trained in sort of what bias looks like and how to detect it and how to sort of make sure that it doesn't get coded into their system. And it can seem like a system is really, really accurate. Like it can, you know, work 97% of the time. And that might seem really great if the 3% of people that it's failing on are all Asian or all African American. That's a problem, and it might not be detected by them because they don't necessarily see it. So one of the people I spoke with said, you know, oh, I don't think it's a problem because those are minor issues. You know, when I asked about, you know, does your system, some of them try to detect gender, and I asked about trans people, and they sort of say, oh, that's a little issue. There's so few of them, it doesn't matter, because they're really looking at a percent accuracy and not necessarily at sort of the human cost maybe that some of this might entail.
So do you think that's a legitimate argument? You know, it's never going to be 100% accurate, so if a few slip through the system, it's okay.
I don't think so. I think in general, technology companies need to be aware of the real world impact of some of this. And particularly when you're talking about groups that are more vulnerable, that are sort of already facing a lot of discrimination, there are little things that add up to just a reminder constantly that, you know, we don't think about you when we design. And also, you know, as you mentioned, facial recognition software is going to be used more and more, maybe as a password, maybe as a way to get in and out of a building. And if the system doesn't recognize you because it's not trained to, that starts to become more and more problematic in your actual life. And there are clear examples of biometrics sort of failing people in pretty catastrophic ways, you know, when trans people travel through an airport. So I think that engineers need to really be aware of the fact that, yes, you're designing a system, and yes, accuracy is important, but it's not just about a percentage. It's also about the people that are impacted by your system.
Well, what can be done to combat this?
So there are some things that are really simple. You know, hire a more diverse team that maybe would see this before it goes out. But also, you know, if you're feeding your system data, make sure that data is diverse. And that's not necessarily a trivial thing to do. It can be difficult to find big sets of face data. And, you know, some places will trawl Facebook and some places will look for public images. But just making sure that you're aware of the data that you're feeding your algorithm, because it really can only learn from something that you teach it. You know, it's like a kid. If you never teach it something, it doesn't know that thing, and you can't really be mad at it for not knowing because you never taught it. And so if you're only teaching it on white faces, then, you know, that's on you to sort of find other sets of data to show your algorithm. And I think also there are a couple of people who work on algorithmic fairness and are trying to kind of see what they can do to, you know, detect and prevent bias in some of these algorithms. And so companies could work with them as well to help sort of try to nip some of this in the bud before it gets blown out and gets shipped out and into a product.
Rose Evela, thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Rose Eveleth is host of the podcast Flash Forward and a contributor to Vice, where she wrote about inherent bias in facial recognition.
I'm John Scalzi, and this is the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop.
And I'm Virginia Prescott with the Hugo Award-winning author of science fiction, both serious and less so. John Scalzi is an internet star from way, way back. He's former president of the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, and perhaps best known for his Old Man's War series, his blog, Whatever, and his novel Red Shirts, which is currently being developed for television. John Scalzi joined us at the NHPR studios while on tour for The Collapsing Empire, the first novel of a new space opera sequence set in an all-new universe. John, which is harder for you to write? Is that first sentence or getting to the finish?
It's always the first sentence because I can spend an infinite amount of time not writing that first sentence.
So what do you do when it's not coming to you?
I would like to say that I spend time in contemplation. What I end up doing is checking out Twitter and answering email and annoying my cats.
So what's the best environment for you writing? You know, what's on your desk? Where are you?
Usually when I'm writing at home, and I have a home office, and literally every book I've written, except for one, has been written there. And it's just a standard-sized room. I had a desk specifically made that is too small to put anything but a computer on to minimize distraction, and it points into a corner of my room. So, you know, I can't even look out the windows. I just have to look at the computer screen. And that's where I usually get most of my work done. I travel a lot now. So I try to get work done when I'm on the road. And I'm only middling successful with that. So when I go home, I have to make up for lost time.
Do you put blinders on?
What I do is I put the electronic version of blinders on, which is between 8 o'clock in the morning and noon, which is my prime writing time. I disconnect the internet because the instant that I am on Twitter or Facebook, I am lost for the day because we live in exciting times. And so it's just very easy to get distracted.
But you have a lot of people following you on Twitter, too. There's a lot of interaction going on there.
There is a lot of interaction. And the way that I talk about the internet, and particularly for me for Twitter, is that it's an attractive nuisance because there are so many people saying so many interesting and clever things there. And it allows me to say interesting and clever things. And when you type on Twitter or online, it feels like you're writing. But it's the equivalent of empty calories. You actually have to actually get off the internet and get the work done. Otherwise, you don't get to eat or keep your house. So that is a prime motivator for me, keeping a roof over my head.
Yeah, so I never thought of that. If you're looking, I have to write 500 words a day. It's not on Twitter. I do follow your blog, sometimes Whatever, which is right now. There's a series of shots looking out from your hotel rooms on tour.
Yes, I'm on tour right now, and this is stop 13 of 24. And so every hotel room that I have, I take a picture out the window because it's fun and because it shows a little bit of the passage of time. But it's also a great way of letting people know a little bit of what it's like to be a touring author. It's like, here's the shot out my window. It's a parking lot. Next day, here's another one. It's another parking lot. I have a whole lot of parking lots going on.
Well, it's kind of funny, too, because they're so banal, right? This is our reality. And I wonder if that was part of the motivation for you writing science fiction. Is there that world building? Is there an exercise there in creating an alternative for you?
Well, I think there's two answers to that. The first was, when I was a kid, I loved science fiction. So it was something that I was used to. And in fact, when I sat down to write my first novel, I literally flipped a coin to either write a science fiction novel or a mystery novel. So if it had landed on tails instead of heads, I might have a completely different career. But the other thing is, yes, I really do like imagining futures. The Collapsing Empire, which is the new book, takes place 2,000 years in the future, and you have so much ability just to make things whole cloth. On the flip side, I recently did a book called Lock-In that takes place only 25 years in the future, and that's actually a lot harder to write because you have to make it logically proceed from the world we live in today. And, you know, some of us are going to be around in 25 years and somebody will show up and go, you said this was going to happen in 25 years and you were wrong.
How much plotting or planning do you do before you even sit down to write? Is this stirring through, or do you, you know, map it out? Do you create a flowchart, outline, anything like that?
Oh, I do not outline. That just sounds so boring to me. I just couldn't do it. I write to find out what I'm going to write. In a very real and concrete way. I usually have an idea of where I want to start. I usually have an idea of where I want to end. And I may have a couple of events along the way that I know I want to get to. But how I get there from, you know, point A to point Z, no idea. But that's the way that I enjoy writing. I like making it up as I go along, because that also gets me really in touch with, am I enjoying what I'm writing? Am I enjoying what my characters are saying? Because I am my first and most critical reader. And if I'm bored writing something, then it's 100% guaranteed that you are going to be bored as well.
What's the best piece of advice about writing that you ever got?
Read out loud what you've written, which sounds really mundane, but I am the sort of person who drops entire words and sentences and, you know, spells things terribly. And quite honestly, reading out loud what you have written not only allows you to keep a copy editor from finding out where you live and stabbing you in the dark because you've given them this terrible, terrible manuscript. But it also means that you get to hear how your work sounds. And one of the things that I found, for example, is if I'm reading a sentence and I run out of breath before the end of the sentence, then maybe I should probably revisit that sentence and see if I could make it a little bit punchier.
Is there a book or a work or something that made you decide you wanted to be a writer?
No. What made me decide I wanted to be a writer was when I turned in a story when I was a freshman in high school, and I got a good grade on it, better grade than anybody else in not just my class, but the other two sections of that class. And I was struggling in my freshman year in high school. I went to a boarding school, and I was a poor kid having, you know, gone from, you know, public school to this rich and snooty private school, which I now love, by the way, Webb Schools of California. But it was such a jolting turnaround of, you know, what my life was, that I was kind of at a loss, and I wasn't doing very well in my classes, and I was kind of confused about a lot of stuff. But here was this thing that I could do well, better than anyone else. And that's when I decided, 14, I'm done. I'm going to be a writer, because clearly I can do this and everything else is hard. Now, unfortunately, I learned later that writing is also hard, but by that point it was too late. You know, I had to be a writer.
John Scalzi, he is the Hugo Award-winning author of the Old Man's War series and more recently his new book, The Collapsing Empire. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
John Scalzi, author most recently of The Collapsing Empire, and our guest for the 40th edition of the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop. Thank you to everyone who subscribed, reviewed, and shared these little nuggets of writerly wisdom. Thank you so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Broke for Free, Ketza, Franco Luzzi, and Human Nature's theme is Caught by a Ghost. And as always, there is loads more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also find us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio and on Twitter at Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.